Welcome to Sci-Fi Tech Talk, the podcast where we explore the technology of sci-fi. I'm Mike McPeak, and with me today is Jeff Sayer.
Hello, everybody.
And Julie Keel.
Greetings.
Yes. And today we are going to right one of the most egregious wrongs that's ever been done on this podcast. And finally, get the idea across that the cinematic piece of dog poop known as Starship Troopers bears just a slight resemblance to the book. And we're going to talk about the book today. Not that I have a strong feeling about this, but you know, this is something that needed to be cleared up here. But let's get into the synopsis of the book. In one of Robert Heinlein's most controversial bestsellers, a recruit of the future goes through the toughest boot camp in the universe and into the battle with the Terran mobile infantry against mankind's most frightening enemy. It's short, it's sweet, but you know, I don't know that it gets the point of the book across. But now, okay, Jeff and I had both read this book, and this is one that we finally, you know, Julie got the time to read. Now, it, you had rather strong feelings about the movie.
to say the least.
And yes, those feelings are like doubled after reading the book. That movie is the biggest pile of shit I've ever seen. I'm sorry, explicit tag time too, but God almighty, this is a good book, and the crap that they did with it in the movie is... somebody needs to, like, be flogged.
Be slapped.
Oh, I'm sorry, they recommend that in the book.
So, oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, the piece of shit, like you said, that's the movie, totally does not capture any of the, you know, really the ideas behind it, the feel of it. This is a serious soldier's story. The book is an absolutely dead serious soldier's story. And the movie is like, you know, high school flirting friends, whatever. I mean,
it's a teenage romp put inside a sci-fi story, more or less.
Yeah, and the book is a philosophical argument and, you know, a moral and political history discussion wrapped in science fiction, which
right,
is one of the purposes of science fiction, in my opinion.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Well,
and you know, whether you necessarily agree with the world that Heinlein creates, he does bring up some serious questions about what does it take to be, you know, a citizen? What are the responsibilities, the duties? You know, and is it just something that should be handed out willy-nilly, or is there some? How do you get the seriousness of what you are doing across to people in a way that will, you know, help them maintain the government that they, you know, have created?
Yeah, Heinlein's universe here says basically the only people that get to vote are veterans.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not willing to put your life on the line for your country, you're probably not qualified to vote. I mean, you can argue till the cows come home whether that's right or wrong, but that's the premise. He believes in corporal and capital punishment in this story. It's a hell of a way to present those ideas and make that far less offensive than if you said, you know, I think everybody should be flogged. You know, when you do it through science fiction, it's much easier to separate the idea from the, you know, emotion of it. You know, you can just kind of look at it and say, you know, in a universe where this is that and that and the other thing, does this work? Does it make any sense? It's much more objective and less threatening, I think, when you deal with it through science fiction. If somebody, you know, was stumping for U.S. president right now and brought this stuff up, holy crap, would the world come down on him. But, you know, presented through science fiction, you can just, you know, put it out there and put it out there. So, yeah, no, this is, the book is very much, like I say, it's a soldier's story. It's not, I understand that it's science fiction, but it really is a soldier's story. There's very little science fiction in it. I mean, they're fighting, they have these suits, they have capsules, they have spaceships, they have bugs. We never do hear what the hell the bugs are, except other than they have workers and warriors and brains and queens, you know, like ants. But in the book, there's really not a lot of time spent describing the enemy other than their bugs, and then their skinnies as well. Other than, you know, the workers and the are mindless. You don't even have to worry about them. They're not going to hurt you even. The warriors are obviously troubled. It's the queens and the brains that you want to go after. But I mean, there's just not really, there's like 10 pages where they actually engage the enemy. I mean, you really don't even hear anything about, you know, the alien life forms.
Yeah, look, it really doesn't glorify war because it doesn't really show a whole lot of it.
No,
right?
No, it glorifies boot camp. You know, the whole book is boot camp. So, I mean, I should have done my research. Heinlein's a veteran, Vietnam War, right?
No, Heinlein was discharged from the U.S. Navy in 1934.
Oh, God.
He was actually... He served in the Navy before World War II.
Wow, so, okay, interesting.
Yeah. So he... I think this book is kind of... Like, it was written in 1959, and I think it's probably his kind of distaste with the kind of the coming, you know, everything that happened in the 60s, because I think he saw that coming and don't think he liked it very much. And he saw that... in a democratic, you know, society, there was a lot more. He felt there was a lot more responsibility required from the citizens than he was seeing, and I think this book is kind of a statement on that.
Yeah, and I mean, if that's your position, this is an interesting way to put it out there. That's far less threatening. You know, like I said, you can actually discuss the idea through this book as opposed to going, you know, absolutely not.
I know Mike and I told you this when we saw the movie, that like that stuff of like, would you like to know more? And that whole, you know, talking with the teacher, that stuff makes more sense when you've seen the book, when you've read the book. I still think, like, you know, it was a real ham-fisted kind of interpretation of the book. But to say the book is just this is one of those things that, like, oh, to just dismiss it as science fiction, wow, you are totally missing out on what this book's...
Right, that's like calling, you know, the Odyssey and the Iliad, you know, an adventure story.
Yeah.
Not hardly.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting, too, that speaking of tech, sci-fi tech talk, there's a lot of tech in the movie that's portrayed that really is not mentioned in the book. For example, what you just said, you know, the whole, you know, newscasts, do you want to know more, that kind of stuff. There's very little tech described in the book other than their suits of armor.
The suits and how they get into battle with being fired in a
capsule.
Yeah.
And that's
One of my disappointments with the movie was, you know, you read the book and they have these suits and they sound really interesting. Like there's something that could be explored there, but in the movie they were just sort of just heavy armor. They're not even the full suits, you know, that they were wearing.
And since my brain has, you know, completely blocked the painful experience of watching that damn movie, I can't even remember what they were portrayed like in the movie. But as I was reading the book, all I could think of was Iron Man with the Jeff Bridges suit of armor.
Oh, Ironmonger.
In Iron Man, where, you know, you have to crawl in there and you can do stuff and you leap over buildings and those kinds of things. So he does go into a little bit of detail on the suits, talking about how they interface with the person wearing them, and it takes, you know, 24 man hours to get them ready to go into service, and they have to be fitted to individuals, and yes, they have like air and toilets and medical and whatever else built right into them. So there was a fair amount of detail on the suits, but that was it. That and the capsules. I mean, if you can imagine crawling into some sort of egg thing and being strapped in with, you know, no windows and no steering, you're just, you know, you're strapped into a chair and shot out the end of a, you know, spaceship / cannon, I suppose you could call it. That's about it.
You're basically a big bullet. And then I found it kind of interesting that they talked about how that as it entered the atmosphere, these layers would start to peel away. First of all, they're protective layers, but secondly, as they started to peel off, they also provided radar clutter, basically, or, you know, confusion for the people trying to shoot you down. You don't know what you're shooting at, kind of cover, because at some point, you have to deploy a chute to slow your entry so you just don't slam into the ground. They're not that good. And there was, you know, you had to do it you if you pulled your chute too soon, you're a sitting duck out there. If you pulled it too late, you're going to slam into the ground. You'd just be another casualty. So I found that part kind of, you know, interesting too. And I trying to remember the movie, but I don't think that was even addressed. I think they were just, weren't they just dropped on the ground?
Yeah, they landed in little drop ships.
Yeah, yeah. So that was, you know, something that wasn't addressed in the movie either, this whole idea of how you get them down on the ground.
See, and in the book, that's such a huge part of it. I mean, that whole being totally no control. You have no control. You don't even know what's going on. You're blind. You have no ability to steer your capsule. You don't have really have much opportunity to change when things, you know, like the parachutes deploy. I mean, you have very, very limited control over that capsule. And that's a huge, huge part of this book. Like I say, this book is like, you know, Marines in the future. And it's very much a one person's experience of, you know, enlisting, going through boot camp, going on some missions, coming back, going through officer candidate school, going on another mission or two, and you know, and that's, I mean, that's the book. There's one big engagement at the end, you know, which takes 10 pages. So it's, you know, it's very much a individual person's point of view as far as joining the military in this universe that Heinlein's created.
Well, and just kind of his growth path from, because when he joined, he was thinking more of himself, but then once he got into the military and kind of got over the hump, because at one point he wanted to quit, but once he got over that hump, realizing there's more than just himself, you know, all of a sudden he became responsible for a squad, and then you know, eventually joined an officer corps, and he realized that, you know, and I think that's the point that Heinlein was trying to get across. We are all individuals, but we are all part of something bigger, and we need to kind of keep that in mind when making decisions, because the decisions that we make as an individual has consequences to society as a whole. And I think that's, and you know, he had kind of a rigid structure, but you know, I think he realized that human beings, the nature of a human being is, if we don't have some sort of guideposts along the way, we're going to kind of run wild. And I think that was his idea of setting up a structured society that would keep people, give them freedom to be individuals, but still kind of maintain the society as a whole.
Yeah. And this is the kind of book that I could see, you know, being like required reading in high school, but it wouldn't be in English class. It would be in,
well,
like political science class.
Or, well, see, I'm actually talking to the English teacher at school, and I've got her interested in this book, and I hope she has the kids start reading it, because, you know, she was talking about, you know, trying to incorporate, excuse me, something in the English class about teaching kids about, you know, government responsibility and this kind of stuff. And I said, hey, here's a wonderful book.
Yeah, no kidding. That would be perfect. If they're covering that in English, that would be great. To me, this seems like more like something you'd cover in history or political science class. Because as a book, as a piece of literature, and you know, even science fiction, there's better options maybe. So, but for like a political science type of class, this would be awesome.
Well, I think it would be one of those opportunities for like a government teacher and, you know, the English teacher to get together, or, you know, maybe I don't know what other classes this might encompass, but to get together and have them read the book. And part of it, you know, as far as the story goes, I mean, it's a good story. But, you know, also the ideas that it brings to it, I think, is also interesting. Could be, and that would be a good joint classroom adventure to go on.
Yeah, it'd be a hell of a discussion starter. That's for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
this is the kind of book that I think you would end up. You have a good chance that you would have parents there would be some parents that would be upset that their kids were reading this.
Right. Yeah, I could see that. It could be controversial. Yep.
Well, yeah, because when I first mentioned the book to the teacher, she hasn't, you know, she's got an audiobook. She hasn't listened to it yet. And I said, you know, talked about her doing it in class. And she said, you know, is there suitable content in there? And she mentioned the movie. And I said, no, the stuff that goes on in the movie, that was eye candy. That was fluff. I don't, you know, that was thrown in there, I think, to attract a younger audience or so. I don't know what it was. But I said, really, I didn't find, you know, outside of maybe not agreeing with his ideas, I didn't find anything in there that I thought would be, you know, patently offensive to most people.
But at least when I was reading the book, you knew when he started to lecture, because it was always through his moral and political philosophy or whatever it was, instructors, that he would lay out his treatise for how government and or society should be laid out, you know. So it was always done, at least for me, it was always done in such a way that you could kind of just go, oh yeah, we're going to slog through this for a while and, you know, see what he's got to say. And then we're going to get back to the story. So it becomes quite easy, I think, to identify when he's preaching, if you want to call it that. As opposed to, it's not sneaky at all. He doesn't just like kind of, you know, slide it in there and it's, you know, 3/4 of the way of the book and you realize what's going on. It's very obvious when he's laying out his ideas for society.
Well, I think he probably did that on purpose, just so you could, you know, he kind of needed to get the framework set up so people could understand this society they lived in, why the importance of, you know, citizenship and everything else, and the, you know, his ideas on discipline and everything else. And I think he did that in a way so that you could kind of juxtapose the two. You'd have the framework to understand why this guy needed to get flogged or why the other guy needed to get hung.
Yeah, it was an interesting insight into military discipline. I mean, they talked about, you know, the responsibilities of you know, commanders, people in command, and so it's not all, you know, privileges of dining halls and, you know, whatever. Yeah. There's a lot of pressure and a lot of things that you have to do when you're in that position.
And it is a good example of military justice in that military justice has the perception from people who aren't in the military that it's cruel or whatever, but it's not there for justice. It's there to enforce discipline. And so as a result, some things that would be a major offense in a civilian court are fairly trivial, like you know, violence among peers is just, you know, in the military, like, okay, well, we're, you know, training people to fight, and if they fight a little bit, well, okay, we'll just kind of keep that a hat on that. But something that is trivial, like theft from a peer, that's a huge thing because it's a betrayal of trust, right?
Mm-hmm.
So and that happens in the book. This guy has punched his superior and thinks it's, you know, well, yeah, he hit me first or whatever, you know, and he thinks this is just a nothing, and he's committed something that he could have got the death penalty for.
Right. Yeah. Even though, and in that particular example, he was told to go to ground and freeze, and he happened to land on an ant's nest, you know. And,
yeah.
It's like, well, tough. You know, so, yeah, it...
It's not about cruelty, though. It's about the fact that when you're in battle, your life depends upon the discipline of the guy next to you and vice versa.
No, but I mean, when I said right. that, I mean that it has the perception of cruelty
yes.
to people that aren't in it, right?
Right.
Right. And that's the point I'm trying to make, is that, you know, we would see it as cruel, but it's the fact yeah. that, you know, when you're in war, you depend upon the guy next to you, and you want him to be as tough as he can be.
And you have to be able to count on them. You have
right.
to know that when you say go to ground and freeze, you're going to go to ground and freeze. I don't care if you landed on a Nance Hill, you know, because when somebody has given that command, there's a good reason for it. And freeze is important, not just, you know, lie as still as you possibly can until you're comfortable. It's just like, do not move or somebody's going to die. And it may not be you. The fact that you moved might mean the guy next to you is the one that gets killed. So, you know, yeah, it is, and that's, you know, you could argue that's not necessarily Heinlein's view of military discipline. That's kind of,
no.
you know,
like there's a great reason why military. Oh, that dog's driving crazy. Well, there's a good reason why armies still conduct drill, and that's like nobody marches into battle shoulder to shoulder anymore. But if you do it for year upon year, it instills instinctive response to a word of command. Somebody shouts something and you do it, you don't even think about it. And you just do that over and over and over again and it becomes instinctive.
Yeah.
I'm just going to step away and kill my dog.
Speaking of, you know, capital punishment.
Or corporal punishment, whichever. Yeah.
There you go.
Well, and even in the book there, they had an example where Rico was conducting a mock exercise or whatever, and he was kind of sloppy about how he discharged one of his, you know, nuclear weapons.
Right.
And even though it was a drill, he got flogged for that. Was it 3 lashes? I forget. But, you know, he got basically lashed for it. And it was just – and even though it was a mock exercise, if this had been real, he could have potentially, you know, killed part of his the people that was under his command, and I think he got demoted for that.
Yeah,
also,
you're not allowed to be casual and slough off just because it's a drill. You have to operate as if it was live, and you know, there's no that can't. I get that, and so, you know, when you talk about the science fiction part, I mean, this is a very good military book. I mean, again, it's one person's journey through enlisting, boot camp, missions, officer candidate school, a big engagement that didn't necessarily go that well. but, you know, in the end turned out to be an important one. It was, you know, it's kind of like people who get medals as you're, you know, going through it. It's utter chaos and bloody hell. And then you come back later and went, oh, that was kind of a big deal.
And I would lose my maple leaf if I didn't mention all the Canadian stuff that's in this, too.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-oh.
It was the boot camp is in
the
Canadian Rockies. They go on leave to Vancouver. The camp itself is called Smokey Smith, who's a Canadian Victoria Cross winner. One of the drop ships was called the General Arthur Curry, who's the commanding general of all Canadian forces in World War I. There's a Sergeant Aubrey Cousins ship, who's he was a Victoria Cross winner from the Queen's Own Rifles of Canada, a regiment that I used to be in. So, yes, it was a load of Canadian stuff.
Is Heinlein Canadian by chance?
No, he's not.
Really?
But, yeah, I don't really know. I haven't been able to see any particular reason why he put so much Canadian stuff in it. I don't know.
Interesting. And it's interesting. I found it interesting, too, that the main character, you know, Rico, is Argentinian.
Filipino. There was they refer to he's from Buenos Aires in the movie, but his mother goes to Buenos Aires in the book.
Okay.
He's from the Philippines.
Okay.
They don't make a big deal about it, but because I had thought that too, and when I was re-listening to it, when they mentioned about I can't remember how it came up, but anyways, they said he was from the Philippines.
Well, because there's something about his dad was supposed to go with his mom on vacation to Buenos Aires, but business called him away, and so she went. Otherwise, they both would have been, you know, killed in that. There's something about her being on vacation down there, and I don't know how he was informed of it, but that's the way it went. Because when his dad enlisted, you know, that was one of the controversial points of the, you know, in his life, was that his father and a lot of people in the in that universe didn't think civil service, you know, was that big a deal. He was kind of angry that his son had joined the military. He thought it was kind of, I forget what it was, but kind of pointless, kind of stupid, kind of useless. Just go into the business. Don't worry about, you know, being able to vote and. When you're a citizen, you can vote and you can get elected to office. That's the two perks that they have above everyone else. And he didn't think it was that big a deal. He's actually kind of angry and disowned his son for quite a while. But then, you know, spoilers here, people. By the end of the book, and after Buenos Aires was, you know, wiped out by the meteor that the bug sent to splatter it, he joined the military and he come around to understand why his son had did this, and you know, there was kind of a father-son reconciliation there. And at the end of the book, was he commander of the ship that his dad was serving on? I
I believe
yes,
so.
Yes, he was, yeah.
Yes. And so there's kind of, you know, a father-son, you know, story going on. They're not as major as the other parts, but there was some of that other stuff there about how, you know, conflicts with parents and how, you know, changing your point of view and coming to understand each other and everything. So that was a minor part of the book.
That was an interesting bit of, you know, you could call it technology because it's kind of how they put their military and or society together. But like it's not common, and I'm not even sure it's possible for your dad to enlist after you have. I mean, just biologically, I think in the U.S. you can't be older than 35. So unless you were 17 and your kid enlisted at 17 or, you know, whatever, yeah. It's pretty – that idea of your father enlisting after you, especially after you've been in for a couple of years, is kind of not real possible in current situation, obviously in the future, whatever. It sounded, and one of the guiding principles they had there too was that it's very difficult to get into the service and very easy to get out. You could just walk away, nobody cared. So right. Those people who actually stuck it out and did their time, and those who made careers out of it, really were those dedicated. And those were the ones where, you know, Heinlein was arguing that they had actually totally earned their citizenship and their rights that they had as citizens.
Well, at the beginning of the book, you know, I think it was just there was just skirmishes going on with the bugs. It hadn't been all out war declared. It wasn't until they hit Buenos Aires with meteorite that the war was actually declared. And so up to that point, military service they were actively trying to discourage people because they didn't have a lot of things for them to do, and that's why they put. Kind of the opposite of what we have for recruiting people now. They would put the people out there with the stumps and, you know, the disfigured people to show them what they were getting themselves into if they joined the army. They were actively trying to discourage people from joining the army. So, you know, in the beginning, this wasn't like a pro... How do I put this? I mean, he's pro-military, but it wasn't like rah, 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 everything for country. At the beginning, they're actually trying to discourage people from joining. And like I said, walk away. They gave people plenty of opportunities because they just didn't, at the beginning, know what to do with all of them.
Yeah, and it very much was a volunteer army. I mean, that was the underlying premise of it all, was that you had to volunteer for this.
Which is something that might be lost on people reading it today, but Heinlein wrote this at a time when the U.S. military was all a conscript force.
Yep. They're still, yep.
Yeah, so that this was like not totally innovative because there were other countries that had all volunteer force, but it was certainly unusual in the United States.
Yeah, and I got mixed up because one of the editions of the book was dated 1987. So for the longest time as I was reading it, I was thinking, wow, 1987, this guy was a Vietnam vet. And then when you said it, I remembered, yes, I realized that was an error. It was in 59. That puts it in a whole different context.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this book could have been written by a Vietnam vet who was pissed off about the way that war went. This thing is like 10 years prior to that,
yeah,
and just kind of totally nailed it, you know.
Yeah.
So that was kind of interesting
because it does have that feel of like, oh, these stupid civilians, they just don't understand.
Well,
sort
he
of
actually called them goody two shoes, you know. These people who are well meaning, but you know, were goody two shoes and didn't, you know, you weren't safe to walk the streets. And it was totally, you know. Like I say, 10 or 15 years later, it would have totally nailed the environment at that time.
Well, and you know, you mentioned Vietnam vet, and okay, Joel Halderman, who wrote The Forever War, which we've done on this podcast,
right,
said he disagreed with Starship Troopers because it glorifies war, but added it was a very well crafted novel, and I believe Heinlein was honest with it. So it kind of, I think, potentially, you know, helped inspire his Forever War. And like I say, he was a Vietnam vet that was disgruntled by the way things happened. But, you know, Heinlein was a military man and saw things that he – with society that he didn't like and said something about it.
See, now that's interesting because Heinlein, Starship Troopers, is very much a war is good and necessary and – you know, there are, it makes men or whatever. Whereas the Forever War was like, war is pointless. I mean, the bottom line of that is, you know, war goes on for eternity and it's kind of pointless. And that is probably based on those two generations' experiences with actual war.
Well, yeah, because I should look. Did we say that he Heinlein had served in any of the wars?
No. But, well, he might. I don't know if he was in any conflict, but he served okay. in the early 30s. So
right. Yeah. Well, and you, you know, you said generational because up until that point, you know, the World War One and World War Two were what you, I guess, you would call. I don't want to say honorable wars, but it was still one of those things that, you know, it was, there was a certain degree of pride that went along with it. And then when Korea came along, you know, it started to lose its luster. And then when Vietnam came along, then, you know, that's when war was a terrible thing. You know, then we saw the inhumanity of it all. And you, that's when we had news reporters there and reporting on all of this. And that's when the, our perception of war is from a good and honorable thing to, you know, this messy quagmire that, you know, drugged people down and got people killed. So I think there was that generational difference there between Heinlein and Halderman on these two books.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think, put him age-wise, if he was old enough to be running military in the early 30s, he was basically my grandparents. And, you know, that was a whole different time. I mean, corporal and capital punishment was everywhere. That was just America at that point. You know, people were getting smacked in schools, which, you know, these days it's completely not allowed. You know, so, yeah, there was just a whole lot of societal change in there, too, that, you know, those two different generations. There's almost three generations. Well, maybe just one, but, yeah. Had changed in that time. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting too, as much as the spaceships and the armored suits were, you know, sci-fi-ish, not much else was. Uniforms were uniforms, cold bedrolls, you know, marching, hiking, whatever you want to call it, going out and camping was kind of the same as it still is. Mess hall was mess hall. Navy ships were Navy ships, you know, fore and aft and officers' quarters. And, you know, they're just, other than this idea of these mechanized suits and these capsules and the fact that you flew in on a spaceship and fought with these bug aliens, that was all you ever heard. There was no real description of what these bugs actually looked like that I can remember. So, you know, they're just, it was very much kind of a current, I mean, it was really approachable, touchable. I mean, you could put yourself in there. It wasn't so far gone that it was mythical and made up and, you know, magic. This was like, okay, and right now, in 2015, those, you know, mechanized suits are probably not science fiction. They might not do everything that they talked about in the book, but they're out there.
Wow.
Well,
not quite.
Not quite. No, I get that, but that is a thing that they're working on. So the idea that that goes another, you know, one or two generations beyond and comes up with something that similar to what they're describing in the book is completely possible. It's not, you know, mythical like unicorns and leprechauns.
I think right now they're kind of at the point of like exoskeletons that you can use for loading stuff, you know, increases a person's power basically.
Yeah.
But they're not to the, but you know, like I say, it's an evolutionary thing. And so, you know, it's possible further down the road that these things will, you know.
I just watched The Kingsman again last night and, you know, those blades, those things you can strap onto your feet, or if you're amputated, yet those are your feet. You know, the idea that those things can make you run faster, jump higher. You know, put that on an exoskeleton suit and see how close we come to the things that are described in Starship Troopers.
Yeah. It's also one of those things that you hear the argument sometimes that, well, you know, machine guns are great, so why doesn't everybody have a machine gun? Well, you know, that's not how things work, right? Then you'd need more ammunition. It becomes, you know, like it's a whole, but like the World War II, the, I can't remember, was one of the German generals said, you know, the Tiger tank was worth four Sherman tanks, but the United States always had five Sherman tanks. So, like, it doesn't matter, like, the, you know, the technology is in warfare is more than just the highest tech is the best. You know, it's what can be produced, what can be brought to the battlefield, what can be serviced. Like, it's just because it's the most high-tech doodad doesn't mean that it's going to be the best in combat, right?
It's not the weapon, it's how you use it.
Yeah.
That's what she said. Oh, I'm sorry. I just couldn't resist that. But, you know, and sometimes it's the lowest tech weapons that actually win. I mean, you know, Vietnam was a great example of that.
Yeah.
It was bamboo that basically was the toughest weapon to deal with in Vietnam. So, well, yeah, like I started off this episode, the book is I was about to say awesome. I'm not quite convinced I'm going to use that word. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's like an 8.5. The movie is like a negative 58.
Oh, you're being generous.
I'd say the book is extremely thought-provoking.
Yes, very much so. Which, in my world, that gets you a whole lot. Whether you agree with it or disagree with it, as long as the arguments are laid out and it's thought-provoking, that's a win. I'm glad I took the time to actually read the book.
Well, yeah, see, this is what Jeff and I had been saying for a while. And, like I say, we have our scale from, you know, Roper Report to Starship Troopers. And, you know, and it's always bugged me if they would have changed the name, because the movie, you know, it's an okay movie in certain respects. You know, it depends what you're looking for, but to have it associated with the name, that's really what
that's what really bugs me. If you'd have called it Starship Cadets or something, and, you know, done the movie that way, so it was built in the same sort of universe, but you didn't want to, you know, connect it with the book tightly, I think it would have been crap anyway, but it wouldn't have pissed me off so I got bad.
And especially once you've read it and realize that really, I've always said that the movie is kind of a mockery of the book. And I can't find it in the stuff I've got here, but somewhere, was it Van Hooven that directed the movie? Hadn't really read the book before he decided to direct it. And he was just, it kind of became a anti-war movie in the fact that they kind of trivialized certain things. And one thing that, you know, was in the movie that, you know, I think we all kind of addressed, and it wasn't really addressed in the book. Yeah, they were on the search for, you know, one of the brain bugs or whatever, but once they got it, they started just, you know, it was like sadism. You know, you got little Doogie Howser there torturing this brain bug, and that was never got across in the book. They wanted to find one, they wanted to research it, but they wanted to find out, you know, you got to understand your enemy in order to fight it. But you didn't get that level of sadism that was almost that the movie portrayed, that these cackling people going and zapping it with a gun. That was just like sadism.
Yeah, that particular scene is the one that makes me foam at the mouth. And especially after reading the book, that's, again, my opinion of the movie was low to begin with. After reading the book, it just frickin' hit, you know, zero Kelvin. It's just beyond stupid. One thing too that the movie did that is not in the book is the movie is very much, you know, friends, high school pals going off to join and whatever, and you keep up. You know, there was a lot more relationships in the, you know, shitty relationships in the movie than there was in the book. There were very few characters in the book, and one of the things you learned very early on in the book: don't get attached to anyone.
No.
So it's very. It's like a soldier. You know, people come, people go, people die, people leave, people get flogged, people show up unexpectedly, including your dad, and you just kind of move on. So unlike the movie where, you know, it was like high school and, ooh, let's go, you know, I can't even remember. All I remember is girls in the shower and guys, you know, punching each other in the hall. I mean, it actually started, and that movie started in the high school hallways, if I remember right. So, yeah, there's a whole lot more of that kind of stuff in the movie that just is not anywhere in the book. At the beginning, there's a talk about him and his high school friend going to enlist. But that, it doesn't, it's just, that's as far, I mean, it's not belittled, I guess, like the movie did.
Well, and I'm by no means a military expert, but to me, this seems like it's kind of a soldier story. You know, it's not necessarily glorifying anything, but it's telling this guy's, you know, trail, his life through all that he's done and the society that he lives in. I don't want to say it puts a positive face on the military, but I don't think it glorifies it. I mean, you know, when they do talk about the military and its necessity, it's about keeping helping to keep a free society. It's not, you know, for the greater good of the nation that we need to invade this country.
Yeah, and I have to admit, my brain kept crossing this with Ender's Game.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. When they kept talking about bugs, I kept waiting for the end of it where they had annihilated all the bugs and, you know, whatever. Oops, spoiler. but... You know, I had to watch myself going, no, this is not Ender's Game. These are different bugs. This is a different universe. You know, and it ends differently. It doesn't really end.
Yeah, as I say, there was no real end to the war. There's a conflict going on. The end.
Yeah, basically, yeah. We had this really big, you know, incident, encounter with the bugs that was, and, you know, I got, like, in there and wounded and whatever and, you know, got a metal because of it, and then, you know, life goes on, the end. It's kind of a anticlimactic ending, but I'm also glad it didn't drag on any farther because there was no point to the story after that.
Well, yeah, and I think if he would have, you know, gone on to this great military glorious victory, then that possibly would have spoiled it and turned it into, you know, a military is all good.
Yeah, because the last thing I wanted to hear at the end of this book is how him and his dad were having a great time on a starship, you know, doing drops. I'm like, no, you know. The only reason his dad showed up later in the book was to promote Heinlein's, you know, point of view that, you know, even somebody like his dad could change his mind and see the benefit of all of this and, be, you know, want to enlist and become a true citizen and, you know, it wasn't so much from a family standpoint, at least the way I was reading it. It was more of a, you know, yeah, even those who thought this was a dumb idea eventually can see, you know, the benefits of it and why it might be important.
Well, yeah, when you're faced with that, you know, the conflict that was going on, because it goes from, you know, the theoretical idea of why you need a military to the realistic view of why you need a military, and for him to see that, you know, in this context anyway, why you needed the military. And, you know, he goes on to join, you know, to help fight this war and to help preserve the, you know, the human race. I think that's the part that was important.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it was nice to have that little loose end tied up too, as far as this whole reconciliation with his dad. You know, his mom's dead. I guess you can't, you know, that's there. But
the people in this book seem kind of secondary to all of the points that he was trying to make.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, like they were just kind of sock puppet people.
See, and that's why the difference between that and the movie is so stark, because the movie is all about this, you know, high school drama relationship, you know, stuff going on. And the book doesn't deal with that at all. Nothing.
Probably the closest relationship outside of his father is what he had with his teacher, you know, Dubois. Yeah. And you know, at certain points throughout there, you know, he talks about how proud he is that he's, you know, gone on to do this and everything else. And that's, you know, about the only other, you know, lasting relationship in there. I mean, he has encounters with his commanders, and he shows some, you know, affection and respect for him. But, you know, they get killed off, or, you know, something happens to him. And so it's, he, yeah, there's not, and I, and maybe that's kind of the point that, you know, you don't really get in when you're a soldier, you don't always have the option of forming long lasting relationships, because sometimes war happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And that hasn't changed, you know, and it won't change between past, present, and future.
Well, let's see. Is there, you know, we've kind of talked about the tech. We kind of talked about, you know, how, the relationship of the book to the movie. Was there any other points we wanted to make about this? I mean, beyond the fact that completely diametrically opposite, you know, from one another.
Yeah, no. I guess what the one of the things that I found is being about diametrically opposite is how, you know, essentially the high-tech equipment, and this is true in the military as well, the high-tech equipment is, you know, side by side with the real low-tech everything else. I mean, I've stayed in military barracks. You know, you got all kinds of great, glorious technology, and then you got a stinking metal rack to sleep on that's, you know, strung together by twine and, you know, straw. So it's, it, you know, it, that, and that continues in the future here as well. So that, that whole idea that in the future everything's going to be really high-tech, or everything's going to be so much better, or, you know, everything's going to be clean and white and shiny, is not the case in this universe.
No.
Anywhere.
And yeah, and the other thing that kind of struck me was the fact that in you know, in his universe, everybody fought, from the cook down to the chaplain.
Yeah, that was an interesting twist. I liked that, actually.
There was no privilege or rank. You know, if there was something going on, everybody, you know, fought. There wasn't, you get to hang back at the, you know, at the back of the battle there. You know, everyone was in there at the front lines. Everyone had to, if you were a cook, you also, you got your stuff together and you went in there and you fought.
Right. And that, they also only select officers from within the ranks. They don't take officers from outside. And he makes a very strong case for why he thinks that's a mistake in modern armies.
Yep. Even if they ran short, they were short officers constantly, yeah. It sounds like. So, yeah, it was better to not have an officer than have an outsider.
Yeah.
Yep. Interesting.
Well, did anybody have any final thoughts on this? Or
you know, one final thought is that this, the way you guys have been talking about it, the way it's ranked in many places, this is kind of one of the sci-fi classics that are out there. And I'm not sure I'm ready to give it that stature. It's an interesting treatise on military and citizenship and, you know, government of some sort. I don't think it can compare to, like, well, like the Forever War and some of the other classic sci-fi that we've looked at. So it's a strong, solid book. It makes a lot of good points, but it's far more of a discussion starter than it is a science fiction story. So...
Well, and to be fair, Heinlein was kind of surprised when it won the Hugo Award in 1960.
Yeah.
So I don't think he was even, you know, expecting the, you know, acceptance that he had gotten with this book.
Yeah. Worth a read, though.
Oh, yeah. And, okay, we ask our usual question, was there any tech in, you know, wasn't a lot of tech, but I mean, was there any tech in here that, you know, struck your fancy?
The suits,
okay. Yeah. It wasn't a lot else. I mean,
it's not tech, but they did mention that the pilots were all women because they had faster reflexes or could multitask. I can't remember what his excuse was, and I don't know what. It wasn't real clear what the spaceships were that, you know, required this, but. That it sounds like the spaceships that they were using to drop were quite interesting. So I wouldn't mind, I don't know if I want to have one, I don't know if I want to pilot one, but I wouldn't mind poking around one of their spaceships to see how they operate and, you know, how they do what they do.
Okay. And, yeah, there wasn't, yeah, tech-wise, there wasn't a lot in there that, you know, got my attention, I guess. But like I say, I just for, like you said, Julie, the discussion of it, I think, is what I like most about this book. This is one where I don't have to have the tech. I think it's just a good discussion piece.
Yeah, it'd be a great book club book.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Well, that wraps up this episode of Sci-Fi Tech Talk. You can check us out at scifitechtalk.com, where there's some cool space junk available for purchase. Pop into the forums there and take part in the conversation, or follow us on Twitter at Sci-Fi Tech Talk. If you have any ideas or comments, please send them to greetings@scifitechtalk.com, and reviews on iTunes are always welcome. Jeff, where can people find you?
People can follow me on Twitter at BroncoSire. That's S-Y-E-R.
And Julie, where can people find out more about you?
I, too, can be found on Twitter at Julie Kuehl, J-U-L-I-E-K-U-E-H-L. And links to the other blogs, podcasts, and whatever else I've got going on can be found at about.me/Julie Kuehl.
And I can be found, for anybody who wants to hear anything I have to say, which isn't much anymore, but I can be found on Twitter at DSC Chipman, and I have an about.me page at about.me/Mike McPeak. That's M-C-P-E-E-K. And next week, we'll be covering the movie Sphere. 1,000 feet below the ocean, Navy divers discover an object half a mile long. A crack team of scientists are deployed to the site in deep sea habitats. What they find boggles the mind as they discover a perfect metal sphere. What is the secret behind the sphere? Will they survive the mysterious manifestations? Who or what is creating these? They may never live to find out. But that's it for this show, and we'll see you in the future.
Where's the matter? Where's the matter? It's the Sci-Fi Tech Talk.